as if the subject were placed momentarily in the magician's body, and able to stare half across the room at her real body, whose eyes blazed and protruded with an alien expression. Asnath often made wild claims about the nature of consciousness and about its independence of the physical frame, or at least from the life process of the physical frame. Her crowning rage, however, was that she was not a man, since she believed a male brain had certain unique and far-reaching cosmic powers. Given a man's brain, she declared, she could not only equal but surpass her father in mastery of unknown forces. Edward met Asnath at a gathering of intelligentsia held in one of the students' rooms, and could talk of nothing else when he came to see me the next day. He had found her full of the interest and erudition which engrossed him most, and was in addition wildly taken with her appearance. I had never seen the young woman, and recalled casual references only faintly, but I knew who she was. It seemed rather regrettable that Derby should become so upheaved by her. But I said nothing to discourage him, since infatuation thrives on opposition. He was not, he said, mentioning her to his father. In the next few weeks, I heard of very little but Asnath from young Derby. Others now remarked Edward's autumnal gallantry, though they agree that he did not look even nearly his actual age, or seem at all inappropriate as an escort for his bizarre divinity. He was only a trifle paunchy, despite his indolence and self-indulgence, and his face was absolutely without lines. Asnath, on the other hand, had the premature crow's feet, which come from the exercise of an intense will. About this time, Edward brought the girl to call on me, and I at once saw that his interest was by no means one-sided. She eyed him continually with an almost predatory air, and I perceived that their intimacy was beyond untangling. Soon afterwards, I had a visit from old Mr. Derby, whom I'd always admired and respected. He had heard tales of his son's new friendship, and had wormed the whole truth out of the boy. Edward meant to marry Asnath, and had even been looking at houses in the suburbs. Knowing my usually great influence with his son, the father wondered if I would help to break the ill-advised affair off. But I regretfully expressed my doubts. This time, it was not a question of Edward's weak will, but of the woman's strong will. The perennial child had transferred his dependence from the paternal image to a new and stronger image, and nothing could be done about it. The wedding was performed a month later by a justice of the peace, according to the bride's request. Mr. Derby, at my advice, offered no opposition, and he, my wife, my son, and I attended the brief ceremony, the other guests being wild young people from the college. Asnath had bought the old Crowninshield place in the country at the end of High Street, and they proposed to settle there after a short trip to Innsmouth, whence three servants and some books and household goods were to be brought. It was probably not so much consideration for Edward and his father as a personal wish to be near the college, its library, and its crowd of sophisticates that made Asnath settle in Arkham instead of returning permanently home. When Edward called on me after the honeymoon, I thought he looked slightly changed. Asnath had made him get rid of that underdeveloped mustache. But there was more than that. He looked soberer and more thoughtful, his habitual pout of childish rebelliousness being exchanged for a look of almost genuine sadness. I was puzzled to decide whether I liked or disliked the change. Certainly he seemed for the moment more normally adult than ever before. Perhaps the marriage was a good thing. Might not the change of dependence form a start towards actual neutralization, leading ultimately to responsible independence? He came alone, for Asnath was very busy. She had brought a vast store of books and apparatus from Innsmouth. Derby shuddered as he spoke the name, and was finishing the restoration of the Crowninshield house and grounds. Her home in that town was a rather disgusting place, but certain objects in it had taught him some surprising things. He was progressing fast in esoteric lore, now that he had Asenath's guidance. Some of the experiments she proposed were very daring and radical. He did not feel at liberty to describe them, but he had confidence in her powers and intentions. The three servants were very queer, an incredibly aged couple who had been with old Ephraim and referred occasionally to him and to Asenath's dead mother in a cryptic way, and a swarthy young wench who had marked anomalies of feature and seemed to exude a perpetual odor of fish. For the next 2 years, I saw less and less of Derby. A fortnight would sometimes slip by without the familiar 3-2 strokes at the front door. And when he did call, or when, as happened with increasing infrequency, I called on him, he was very little disposed to converse on vital topics. He had become secretive about those occult studies, which he used to describe and discuss so minutely, and preferred not to talk of his wife. She had aged tremendously since her marriage. Till now, oddly enough, she seemed the elder of the two. Her face held the most concentratedly determined expression I had ever seen, and her whole aspect seemed to gain a vague, unplaceable repulsiveness. My wife and son noticed it as much as I, and we all ceased gradually to call on her, for which Edward admitted in one of his boyishly tactless moments, she was unmitigatedly grateful. Occasionally, the Derbys would go on long trips, ostensibly to Europe, though Edward sometimes hinted at obscurer destinations. It was after the first year that people began talking about the change in Edward Derby. It was very casual talk, for the change was purely psychological. But it brought up some interesting points. Now and then, it seemed Edward was observed to wear an expression and to do things wholly incompatible with his usual flabby nature. For example, although in the old days he could not drive a car, he was now seen occasionally to dash into or out of the old Crown and Shell driveway with Asenath's powerful Packard, handling it like a master, and meeting traffic entanglements with skill and determination utterly alien to his accustomed nature. In such cases, he seemed always to be just back from some trip, or just starting on one. What sort of trip, no one could guess, although he mostly favored the Innsmouth Road. Oddly, the metamorphosis did not seem altogether pleasing. People said he looked too much like his wife, or like old Ephraim Waite himself in these moments. Or perhaps these moments seemed unnatural because they were so rare. Sometimes, hours after starting out in this way, he would return listlessly sprawled on the rear seat of the car, while an obviously hired chauffeur or mechanic drove. Also, his preponderant aspect on the streets during his decreasing round of social contacts, including, I may say, his calls on me, was the old-time indecisive one, its irresponsible childishness even more marked than in the past. While Asenath's face aged, Edward's, aside from those exceptional occasions, actually relaxed into a kind of exaggerated immaturity, save when a trace of the new sadness or understanding would flash across it. It was really very puzzling. Meanwhile, the Derbys almost dropped out of the gay college circle. Not through their own disgust, we heard, but because something about their present studies shocked even the most callous of the other decadents. It was in the third year of the marriage that Edward began to hint openly to me of a certain fear and dissatisfaction. He would let fall remarks about things going too far, and would talk darkly about the need of gaining his identity. At first I ignored such references, But in time I began to question him guardedly, remembering what my friend's daughter had said about Asna's hypnotic influence over the other girls at school, in cases where students had thought they were in her body, looking across the room at themselves. This questioning seemed to make him at once alarmed and grateful, and once he mumbled something about having a serious talk with me later. About this time, old Mr. Derby died, for which I was afterwards very thankful. Edward was badly upset, though by no means disorganized. He had seen astonishingly little of his parents since his marriage, for Asenath had concentrated in herself all his vital sense of family linkage. Some called him callous in his loss, especially since those jaunty and confident moods in the car began to increase. He now wished to move back into the old family mansion, but Asenath insisted on staying in the Crown and Shell house, to which she had become well adjusted. Not long afterward, my wife heard a curious thing from a friend, one of the few who had not dropped the Derbys. She had been out to the end of High Street to call on the couple, and had seen a car shoot briskly out of the drive, with Edward's oddly confident and almost sneering face above the wheel. Ringing the bell, she had been told by the repulsive wench that Asenath was out, but had chanced to look at the house in leaving. There, at one of Edward's library windows, she had glimpsed a hastily withdrawn face, a face whose expression of pain, defeat, and wistful hopelessness was poignant beyond description. It was, incredibly enough in view of its usual domineering cast, Asenath's. Yet the caller had vowed that in that instant the sad, muddled eyes of poor Edward were gazing out from it. Edward's calls now grew a trifle more frequent, and his hints occasionally became concrete. What he said was not to be believed, even in centuried and legend-haunted Arkham. But he threw out his dark lore with a sincerity and convincingness which made one fear for his sanity. He talked about terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins in the heart of the main woods, beneath which vast staircases led down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that led through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous exchanges of personality that permitted explorations in remote and forbidden places on other worlds and in different space-time continua. He would now and then back up certain crazy hints by exhibiting objects which utterly nonplussed me, elusively colored and baffling textured objects, like nothing ever heard of on Earth, whose insane curves and surfaces answered no conceivable purpose and followed no conceivable geometry. These things, he said, came from outside, and his wife knew how to get rid of them. Sometimes, but always in frightened and ambiguous whispers, he would suggest things about old Ephraim Waite, whom he had seen occasionally at the college library in the old days. These adumbrations were never specific, but seemed to revolve around some especially horrible doubt as to whether the old wizard were really dead, in spiritual as well as corporal sense. At times, Derby would halt abruptly in his revelations, and I wondered whether Asenath could possibly have divined his speech at a distance and cut him off through some unknown sort of telepathic mesmerism, some power of the kind she had displayed at school. Certainly, she suspected that he told me things, for as the weeks passed, she tried to stop his visits with words and glances of a most inexplicable potency. Only with difficulty could he get to see me, for although he would pretend to be going somewhere else, some invisible force would generally clog his motions and make him forget his destination for the time being. His visits usually came when Asenath was away, away in her body, as he once oddly put it. She always found out later. The servants watched his goings and comings, but she evidently thought it inexpedient to do anything drastic.